All right. Welcome, everyone. My name is Will Schroer, and I'll tell you a very little bit about myself on the next slide. But welcome to City God, and part of our purpose here will be to fill in that blank and talk about what the correct relationship between those two things is. Of course, the famous, American Sermon by John Winthrop spoke of a city of God with two T's. We sometimes talk about claiming the city for God, or claiming things, or doing things
city
for
God.
When we talk about creation, we talk maybe about God will create the city, so the city by God, sign at the bottom. But there's a relationship here, right? And we talk about cities in a certain way, and we talk about God in a certain way. Many of us live in cities. Actually, let me get a show of hands right now. Who lives in what you would think of as a city? Which would leave people who live in the country. Okay, very good. Of the people that identified as living in cities, who here would say that they live in a suburb? Very interesting. All right, very good. So there's a relationship here, and we want to talk about what that relationship is, and I hope to have I'll talk at you for a while, but we're going to talk with each other as well. Folks always want to know, why should I believe what you're saying? So I will tell you a little bit about who I am and where I come from. Jonathan, hi. On your way in, there's a couple of pieces of paper left in the back there. And I walked up front with the pens. I'm going to press Chris Sharon in the pen duty, if you would. Thank you. So, I have a number of what I hope are true identifying adjectives.
What's a
Rebbitzin? The Rebbitzin is the rabbi's wife, and I happen to be the rabbi's wife. Pastor Pam Fekencher is here in the front row, and...
We can debate about whether he's really a wife.
We can definitely debate. No debate whatsoever.
He's the father of me.
I'm the father of him, exactly. And Katie in the back, who's reading the candy makers. So they may or may not weigh in at appropriate or inappropriate times. So I'm from Minneapolis, and the other reasons why you don't have to believe anything I say, of course, you may consider what I say. Because I have 20 years in working in and for, I would say, cities. I started out at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. I was a consultant for 12 years with a large national firm doing city and urban planning and transportation planning with an eye toward low environmental impact and livable cities. And then I was with a nonprofit that kind of worked for those same things. And now I'm with the Minneapolis and St. Paul Chambers of Commerce trying to bring the business community to work for raising more money and spending more money on transit.
Light rail transit.
Yes. This is the Amen corner down here.
So. Yeah, that's me.
So as I said in my little staff description, I have the trifecta of public, private, and nonprofit experience. I hope that is useful as we talk together today. So I know that not everyone is going to come to all five sessions, and I'm delighted that you're at this one. Today we're going to talk about why we build what we build, and tomorrow we're going to talk a little more about what we want out of cities. Cities were created, some would say they were created first for protection. People clumped together for protection. And there are certainly early cities that did that, but the really early cities came together for contact and relationship and trading. In the Fertile Crescent, there was not warfare at that time. People came together to trade and establish religions, and once they had the agricultural surplus, then they had, you know, time to think and write stories and invent writing, etc. All those things happened in cities. And we now have other expectations of cities. Are we getting those things out of the cities that we have? And if not, why not? And what can we do about it? as soon as we start asking, well, what can we do about the problems that our cities have, then economics rears its ugly head. Much of my training is in economics, and but I'm not going to tell too many economist jokes. What I am going to do is talk, especially on Wednesday, out of this book called If You're So Smart, The Narrative of Economic Expertise, and I'll point to it on a couple of other days, basically suggesting that economists are storytellers, and they tell a lot of stories that, that begin once upon a time, right? There was a city that was in trouble, and then they did this thing, and then it got better, and in the end, they lived happily ever after, right? Every story that an economist tells is some variation on that old story. And so I'm going to talk about the kind of stories that we tell each other, and then we can start testing them against, is that a good story or a bad story, and how do we feel about that story? This was not available for order in the bookstore, but you can certainly borrow it if you like. It's a fantastic book. On Thursday, we'll talk about children in cities. Who here walked to school? Whose children walked to school? Okay, there you go. So what happened, right? And we'll talk about cities in particular from the perspective of children. And then we'll really get in on Friday on what then shall we do? Is there a way we can get some of the good stuff back? Can we create new good stuff that we never had in the quote-unquote good old days? And then we'll talk about options and hopeful options going forward. So, hope to see you in other days. And if not, the other thing, and this brings me to slide. Most of my inspiration for this course comes out of a book called Sidewalks in the Kingdom, New Urbanism and the Christian Faith. Eric Jacobson was a pastor in Missoula, Montana, and started thinking about, where do I run into my parishioners, and how am I doing ministry in Missoula versus other places that are on the fringes of Missoula or around Missoula, and wrote just this fantastic book on the intersection of Christianity and city planning. So big debt to Eric Jacobson, and I ordered a bunch of these for the bookstore. They left Nashville last week. I was in the bookstore today. They're like, yeah, they should be here any day. So look for them tomorrow if you're interested, or certainly take a look through it tonight if you would like. Any questions about the course or the goals before we dive in? Comments? Too hot? We have the door open. All right. So, what do we? Why do we build what we build? So, everyone has a piece of paper and a pen. We're going to click through a bunch of pictures, and you're going to rate them quickly. This isn't a deep think exercise. I'm really going to click through them in about 4 seconds per, and just number each one. So, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. And then when you see it, put a number next to it, and the bigger number is better. 5 is I like the less. Okay. So this is, we haven't started yet. This is number one. Okay? So write number one and then your reaction. 1 is bad, 3 is eh, 5 is I love that place. I would love to look.
So I'll just write the number down.
We're gonna go quick here, food. Okay, 4. This is number 4. Now we're at number 5.
Ooh! I want 100.
Okay, 100 for that one.
Is that a sidewalk next to the cars, or just space that's got a line through?
Well, that's a good question, and you can draw your own conclusions. Number 10, halfway through.
not with traffic jams. Yep, I'm here.
The original plan for Holden.
Okay. Ooh. Rainy. Oh, yeah. Ooh, also love the 100.
Yes. 23. Right, that's it. And a little high tech thing here.
Okay, here was my order. Three.
Okay, just a moment. All right. Now, when I do this professionally, I take the numbers very seriously and we spend a lot of time writing them down. We won't do that right now, but we will go a little bit. So, number one, any ones? Any threes?
Wait, oh, yeah.
Any fives? Anything else?
Four.
A couple fours, okay. That's all right. No, that's good. All right, number three. Any ones?
Number three.
Yes.
Oh,
no.
Hold it. Number three.
Oh,
sorry.
I'm gonna skip.
Yeah. Okay.
So three.
You're on three.
Yeah. Any ones?
Oh, three.
Three.
Number three.
Okay. One. Two. Three.
Don't forget to count me.
Four. And five. Three fives. Okay, five. Number five. Any ones? One. Any
no,
twos?
No, there are two ones.
Okay, all right. Any twos? A two. Any threes? Five, six,
oh, no,
threes.
No, no, no. That wasn't a one. That was a 100.
Oh, because of the train?
Yeah.
Any fours?
Another 100.
And any fives? Number seven. Any ones? Any one? Okay. Any twos? Three twos. Any threes? Any fours? And any fives? Number nine. Any ones? Any twos? Two. Any threes? Any fours? Any fives? All right, now we're going to go over to the side. Number two. Any ones? Twos? Threes? Eight. Any fours? Any fives? 1 4 and 1 5?
Okay.
Number four, any ones? I'm going to go with 20 ones. Any twos? Three? Four? Five. Okay, number six, any ones?
Wait.
Twos? Three?
I'm going to say 15.
Wait, did you get me?
Threes.
And four? Five. We'll just do a couple more here. Maybe you're starting to see a pattern. Number eight, any ones? Number two, any twos?
Two, three, four, five.
Threes on number eight. Any fours? Any fives? 1 5. All right. What can we tell here? And so the odd numbers are one kind of place, and the even numbers are another kind of place. And you know, I try not to hit people over the head too hard, and most places have mixed characteristics. No place is all good or all bad. And places will appeal to different people in different ways. So there's no right answer, right? Let's see. We've got number one here. We had 14 fives, 13 threes, fours and fives, threes, eight fours, eight fives, 10 fives, nine fours. These tended toward the 3, 4, and five end, right? And again, no right or wrong answer. There are five people who like these kinds of places, and that's fantastic. There are some fives, a lot of ones on these kinds of, on the even numbers, right? And we can click back through, and you can take a look back at those. But these are results that I see around the country and in all kinds of places, okay? And what it says to me and to others is that there are things that we can, in fact, say about what people like and don't like and in their places. They like to see people, and people will only come to places where people can be safely. There are a lot of names for that. Pedestrian friendly is one. People like other people, and they like to see other people. That makes them feel good about that place. They like trees. They like places where a lot of things are happening, and that is the product of some other things. So there's a definition to this place. There's a two or three story building on each side of the road that creates a sort of a room feel. People like to feel like they're in sort of a room, even if they're outside. The fact that there's a store here, but then there are apartments up here, means that there are probably more people likely to be in the place. It's not all about cars. There's people walking. There's some transit in some cases, although there wasn't in a lot of places. In the pictures, you don't see wires overhead. The utilities are below ground in this picture. And even if there weren't a light rail here, having a grassy median makes people feel better that A, it's green. B, if you're walking across the street, you can stop there. It's not that there's not a lot of traffic. Actually, this street does see a lot of traffic. It's just that it doesn't overwhelm the scene. And then what do people not like? Well, they like the exact opposite. They dislike the exact opposite. So, and this is the exact same place, right? It's just been treated a little bit differently, so we try and hold things at least a little bit constant. So they say that they like in different circumstances wide streets because they think that means that they can get from one place to another quickly, but they don't like the place that results from that policy. They don't like narrow sidewalks. They don't like a lot of traffic signs, and this isn't even the worst case of that. And then they don't like seeing a lot of overhead utilities and things. These are result. You are completely average, for better or for worse, and well, just maybe slightly
average.
But these are results that people give all the time, and. I heard someone say, where are these pictures from? They're from around the country. When I will do this in a place, I will spend maybe the day before going around and taking pictures just from that place. And every city has a mix of places, right? And some are built some way and some are built another way. And so that, when people started doing this, and this was the brainchild of a guy called Tony Nelson, who calls it the visual preference survey. And when people started doing this, you know, it was back before the computers and people would trade slides. Oh, I have a really good picture of this, you know. One of them just had palm trees in it, and you could never use that, you know, north of the Mason-Dixon line. That doesn't apply because it has palm trees in it. But, you know, that wasn't the point, right? The point was the sidewalk, but people would dismiss it because it had palm trees. So now we try and customize this. But it doesn't matter where you are. The same principles tend to apply. So the other interesting thing is that the places that scored high are now the places we no longer build. And the places that score low are the places we tend to build a lot these days. And I think Paul talks about why do I do the thing I hate, do the thing I love. And so that's the rest of today's class, if we haven't spent too much time. So the answers are, and I will click through these semi-quickly, is that we will, by law, fund this, and I'm sorry it's a crappy picture, although you can just imagine squinting through a buggy windshield. And to build this, you have to kind of raise your own money, and you have to get an enormous number of variances, and highway engineers just hate street trees. They hate them, because you can run into them. A transit stop, that's a whole different source of money, and we're not going to pay for that, so forget it. And this is totally legal and totally funded, and you don't have to get permission from anyone to do it. Just go to town. So, money. Second, zoning. Again, the law says that in a lot of communities, now I'm very careful with the blanket statements, but in a lot of communities, this is what's called by right development. If you own the land, you have the right to develop it like this. And if you want to, say, do a conservation development, which is one of the terms for this, and so it's the same amount of land, same number of people, right? So you're not putting any more people in the street or in the schools or anything else. But you want to build the houses over here and then keep this as park for everybody? This is not, you have to get a variance for this. This is illegal because these lots are too small in a lot of communities. We have minimum lot sizes in this community, and you can't build a lot that small. I'm sorry. You have to go to the city council. The city council has a lot of concerns about Agenda 21, and the guy just throws up his hands and says, oh, fine, I'll do this. Okay, so, and then the third thing is, I have an architect friend who says that the main problems that he faces in designing buildings these days are, his top three problems are parking. And this is actually a very nice downtown district, very nice building that they spent a lot of money to build. The only way they could get the permission to do it was to put in a pile of parking, and this really breaks up, to me, the streetscape. You'd be walking along, maybe there's a nice cafe here, and boom, cars coming in and out, etc. And that structured parking, it's actually pretty nice. Now, if you have a big surface parking lot, that's another thing, but again, by law, in most communities, you have to put in a substantial amount of parking per thing that you're doing. And a friend of mine, Don Chu, who studies parking, interestingly enough, has looked back at, he's looked through all kinds of zoning ordinances, and, you know, churches, for example, often have a certain number of required spaces per pew, or funeral parlors per casket viewing station. You know, where do these numbers come from, right? But they're the law. So. What happens is they tend to go to one funeral parlor and, like, far, you know, Minnetonka, and of course everyone has driven there, so they're like, well, that's the minimum number. Yeah. Anyway, so there's a big, you know, we can talk a lot about where do those numbers and those laws and those regulations come from. Some of them come from our own attitudes. They weren't handed down from on high. Our city councils wrote them, our, you know, federal government passed them, etc. And so on the last chunk of time here, I'd like to talk about where the attitudes that inform those policies come from. And interestingly enough, and again, I recommend highly the inspiration for this section for this book, is Christianity, and are we as Christians pro-city or pro-place? And we can talk about non-city places as well, like this, for example, or about the part of the Cascades that is not Holden. That is a place as well. How do we feel about that place? Do we want places to do certain things, and does Christianity have expectations out of those? Or are all places sort of expected to serve similar functions? But right now, we'll just talk about the city. So I started out talking about how the city originated from a need and a desire for contact with each other. And what kind of contact is that? Well, some of the first cities were there for commercial contact. You would come in and trade, right, on market day, and then you would go back to your farm. There's always the social aspect. People come together at the pub, say, right? And that's, you don't have pubs out in the middle. Sometimes you have pubs out in the roadhouse in the middle. Mostly they're in cities, because that's where people are, and then people come to those places. Again, at the risk of making too many broad statements, art tends to flourish more in cities. Now, sometimes that's because that's where the money is, and so there's some surplus to support art in those places. But when people come together, they also like to have art around them, and so cities tend to both produce and be and
hello.
Hello. No worries. Everything is very modular here. There were the religious and educational functions of cities too, right? In some cases, first the city came and then the church came because that's where people were. In other cases, the monastery was there first and then the city kind of grew around that, right? And then finally, educational, same deal with the universities. But anyway, the city supports the whole person, perhaps with the exclusion of actually raising food that those people need, which is an important part as well. But because of that, the sociologist Claude Lévi-Strauss says the city is the greatest human invention, and I don't know if that's really true or not, but I kind of like it. It's thought-provoking to me, and it really does support all these parts of the city. So why not love the city? Well, there's a lot of things wrong with the city too, and all of them I think can be classed under forced contact. Yeah, contact is good. We're social beings, but you want to have contact on your own terms when you want it, and all of these things are aspects of contact that you don't want. And the bottom line is that these are all forms of strangers that you don't want to deal with, and I'm completely sympathetic with that, of course. This is a tension that is developed in Scripture, and for this view, I turn it over to...
I think you should stop a second, because you just went through a whole lot of stuff really fast.
Okay.
Just give people a chance to...
Sure. Very good.
Okay. All right.
I kind of piled this all on. A lot to say, and I'm looking at the clock. But thank you, Pam, for so reactions. Breathtaking. And this is the place where one can talk about the origin, for starters, of, for example, zoning codes. So American cities developed for all the reasons I just went through. And one of the things that American cities were, and other cities for that matter, but especially American, were industry and people kind of all packed together. And they were jumbled in a way which European cities weren't always, although they had other problems. But the famous example is, you know, do you want to live next door to a meatpacking plant? You probably don't. And so always the good, we can fix this kind of can-do attitude. Americans said, well, we'll plan this all out. We'll have the meatpacking plants over here. We'll have the residential areas over here. We'll have the commercial areas over here. And you can, you know, it started out being let's have an actual, it wasn't even about attitudes. It was about safety, literally. I mean, people got sick living next to the meatpacking plants. So let's have a safe town. And once you start thinking that way, that we're going to divide land uses, then it kind of keeps going. Well, if we don't want to live next to the meatpacking plant, maybe we also don't want to live right next to the grocery store. I mean, we want to be close to the grocery store so we can shop at it, but maybe we don't want next to it, because the 7-Eleven keeps the lights on all night, and, you know, bad people come.
And we can drive there whenever we want.
Well, exactly. Although that wasn't the case in the very beginning. But you can see how it starts, right? So let's put these guys over here and we'll be over here. And not even in a bad way, in a good way. But it's kind of snowballs and it takes off. And then planners say, you know, for better or for worse, I think that this is a part of town where we should have large lots, right? For any number of reasons, some good, some bad. And as soon as you say, well, this is the large lot part of town, then any deviation from that, even if it's within the original desires, it's safe, it provides for green space, et cetera. It's not, the original thinking has gone away, and all that's left is the regulation on the books, and no one really knows why, but what they do know is that they don't like change. I moved to this part of town because I like large lots, and I don't want any change to that. And so as soon as you start talking about doing it in a different way, there's a long conversation that has to happen, yes?
Is there an origin, so much American cities, the house is in the center, and the yard is all the way around the house, rather than lot line,
yep.
A different shaped yard, and
yep.
Some things are doable that way, but
yep.
Aren't if it's in the middle of all the
sure.
space.
Yeah. Again, there's a long history. Where do those things come from? Some of them are, again, in regulation in a lot of places. A lot of them are in attitudes. My home is my castle. I want other people to be as far.
You put this moat of grass.
Exactly. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I was showing a friend of mine a new house. Not a new house, but a house that was going to be new. And from a certain angle, and she said, oh my God, that's what we used to call a cup of sugar house in New England. And I said, what the hell is that? That's where you could reach across to your neighbor and get a cup of sugar. And some people like that and some people really don't like that at all. Yes?
You started off asking how many of us live in cities, mm-hmm. how many of us live in rural suburbs, but what's your definition of city? Because I didn't raise my
yeah, right.
hand. There's a lot of
right.
towns and others. So
right.
What's your working definition?
Well, that's a great question. And I actually don't have a strict definition. I find a lot of people that live in what would, most regions have a central city, Minneapolis and St. Paul. And if you're not in one of those two cities, formally you're in a suburb. But there are a lot of places in those suburbs which I would call cities, right? And so it's less a political or how far from the center are you and more are there a lot of uses there? Can you walk around in them? Are there different kind of people in them? Are they self-sustaining? Not that everybody has to get along by themselves. You're in a region because you want to be part of the region, right? But is the city more or less self-sustaining? Or could it be? And that, I guess, would be my...
So Holman could use it.
I think so. I think, and I, that's a great question to ask. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes?
My question has to do with the picture that's up there.
Yes.
So you got, let's say the builder has two choices. You can build the one on the left, you can build the one on the right. Same houses, same
mm-hmm.
thing.
Yeah.
Does he make more money with one or the other?
It depends where the builder is and how much conversation has happened around it. And I think on Friday, when we talk about what then should we do, I'm going to talk about how people are actually willing to pay more for this now. It used to be that no one knew what this was, right? And before you spend however much money people spend on a house, you are a little nervous if this is not a product that has been in your area before, and so you don't know, am I going to be able to sell it, am I going to lose money, et cetera. But once people get familiar with this, and again, people have all kind of tastes, et cetera, but increasingly people are willing to pay much more for this than they are for this, but that it doesn't start out that way.
My concern is, where is the affordable housing?
Well, that's a great question, too.
Yeah.
Absolutely. 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 And it's one of those... good news, bad news situations where because there's such a pent-up demand for this that even though you can build it for less because you have to lay less sewer, less rent, et cetera, it's actually cheaper to build. But there's so much pent-up demand that the price gets bid up very quickly, and so it's not, and people are like, then they say, oh, you're just building houses for rich people because it gets bid up. But no, it's not. It's not intrinsically more expensive. It just... If you could build enough of it, the price would come down again.
Hasn't Portland done
that
quite well?
Yes.
The one on the right?
Yes. Well, and increasing numbers. You were going to say?
I was going to say, has anybody run the numbers, though, on, I mean, because transportation is frequently not far down the list on people's top expenses in their lives.
Number two.
You know, if you run the numbers on,
yes.
If one community demands that you have a car for getting anywhere,
yes.
What does that do to your total cost of living compared to one that has?
This is another day as well. I want to stick with attitudes today. So, let me just say in the middle of things, maybe I should have said at the beginning. My view here is pretty clear, I think, and maybe that I like to think of it as I came to this, you know, after having experienced different things. Some people would just call it a bias. I happen to be, until I was nine, lived on a subdivision far out in the country, and my parents drove me to work every day. So that was what I knew. And now we, through a long series of stories, Pam and I live in a fairly dense part of Minneapolis. We have one car for two working people, and, you know, we walk and bike, and I take the bus every day to work, et cetera. So my view is that I think that there should be more such neighborhoods. It is not that everyone should live in those neighborhoods, but that they should be available, and there's not enough of them available today. And so some of my passion on the subject comes from that frustration with that lack, and I think there should be more availability of those things. But I will say that I have experienced all of these in spades. I had my phone stolen out of my hand while waiting for the bus last month. Yeah, you're sitting there going, doop, and the guy runs by. So it happens, and I'm in no way blind to the problems with the cities. And I, as you may know, don't always do so well with strangers myself, but I think it's a fantastic place to live, and the trick is to balance the good parts and the bad parts. So now, if that's enough of a breather, Pam.
I'm not getting it off. So obviously this kind of gives away some of the tensions, but you can probably all think off the top of your head even of, if you think about cities and those sort of those negative images we have of cities and maybe more positive ones, that tension is actually in scripture as well. And I would also say it's in, that same tension exists for wilderness too. So we could have a whole other session on, you know, is wilderness a refuge or is it a wasteland? Is it the place of exile or is it the place of renewal? Both images exist in scripture, and the same can be said for cities, that there is that both of those. Obviously a lot of Old Testament examples here, but the very first one being Cain, the brother who kills his other brother, somehow, you know, don't think too hard about what this total world population is, as far as scripture goes at this point, but scripture says that he was basically cast into exile by that deed, and then, you know, broken relationships with his parents, his brother's dead, and God places a mark of protection upon him, but also he is basically cast out from the family and eventually builds a city. So even from the very beginning, the first city is founded by a murderer. So yeah, sort of a mixed message there. But in Numbers, when the people enter into the promised land, they are told you need to designate certain cities within your community, designate places for those who have unintentionally killed another, so that there is a place of refuge from revenge. There's a place where that person might go and start over, basically, because that community, the former community, has been broken and they need to start over. Interestingly, I think that often that's a story I've heard actually rather often from people of, you know, why did they land where they landed? If they're in a big city, sometimes that's their story. They have somehow broken relationship with people of the past, and the city is a place to start over. Some people go to Holden, I suppose, to start over, but many people go to a new place where there are strangers, where you can start new relationships, and that actually is scriptural. And then, of course, there's the images of the cities of vice, Sodom and Gomorrah, which were destroyed for lack of hospitality, but the most famous probably destroyed cities. And then Nineveh, that great city of vice that Jonah is sent to, that is many days' walk across, and he has to go and proclaim God's judgment upon it. So we have those images, and then we have Jerusalem, which is almost an entire another category, right? Jerusalem, which becomes the center
of the Jewish people's relationship with God. It becomes the site of the temple. It is built by David, the greatest king they ever had. The one slice of time that's sort of the golden age of their history where they're not ruled over by other empires in David's reign is the time when that city is really built and consolidated and gains its identity. And its destruction by the Babylonians is the seminal, you know, moment in scripture of wondering where God is and what could God possibly be doing if Jerusalem is destroyed. So that image of a place which is the center of worship, the center of community, the center of relationships, of good relationships, of good government, of good good worship life, of good community is also existent in a sort of idealized way throughout scripture of Jerusalem as being the place, the pilgrimage, the place you would go to worship your God. And finally is the image that Revelation gives us of the new heaven and the new earth is a new city. Not a new wilderness, a new city. But there's a tree and there's a stream in the middle. I mean, this is it's not devoid of natural world, but it's very clearly a city that is the final image and revelation of God's redemption for all of creation. So all those relationships are restored in that moment. So both images exist, and we can talk about a little bit about why it is that in our country, I think sometimes the more negative image is the one that's held up more often. But.
Okay. That was when I first read that, and I was sharing it with Pam, and she said, oh, yeah, absolutely. I said, well, I guess that's why you go to seminary to get all this stuff. any questions on that specific, on the tension in Scripture around cities? Okay. So, I thank you, Pam, for having me slow down a little bit. I was rushing in part because I really do want to have time for some conversation here. So let me just sort of recap a little bit, and then I really do encourage us to turn around and talk with each other. So I am often asked, once people figure out what I do, and I figure out how to tell them what I do, well, I saw this thing, and it didn't make any sense, and where did that come from, and why do we do it that way? And there's always an interesting story behind it. But they really do boil down to, what we have today is in absolutely no way an accident. It has been everything that we drive on and live on and how we get between where we live and where we drive has been planned and put down in regulation about how wide it should be and how it should look to the nth degree. And I haven't yet used the word sprawl because a lot of people find it pejorative, but there is a nice phrase which I think captures it. It's the DNA of sprawl. All of that stuff happens because there is a very tightly written set of rules and regulations, some public, some private, that cause it to look that way. And those come from someplace. They're written in a lot of cases by various kinds of engineers or architects or planners, etc. But ultimately, I don't think we can blame too much on them because they are elected and paid for, etc., by ourselves. And the regulations shape attitudes that we have. And so what I'd like to spend the last 10 minutes of class doing is talking about what those attitudes are and where you think they came from and if there's a way that we might bring them together in a different way. Lynette. You look...
Well, I was just thinking, actually, Will and Pam and I live in the same neighborhood, Minneapolis. And I was just thinking of a recent battle, and it is a very urban village within the neighborhood. And it's walkable, and there's transit, and there's apartments. But there was recently a developer who tried to get a five-story condominium built on a corner that now has a kind of a fast foody restaurant. And a parking lot.
Right.
Park
too. Oh, right. And the community, the neighborhood, which I always thought of as really progressive and in favor of more dense population, went crazy because they thought it was too high, it would have too many people, too many cars, and it was really a real a revelation to me that mm-hmm. even people who don't live in suburbs, even people who live in a walkable neighborhood, don't want change and don't want more density sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it was really frustrating for
but
me.
But at five stories, it was two stories higher than any other building that would have been near.
Well, that
but
was
not higher than the billboard across the street.
No,
and not higher than an apartment a block away that was built in the 60s.
Excuse apartment building, because in this country, they build these ugly apartment blocks, and there's no businesses underneath them anymore. There's no place
right.
to go down and get your groceries or.
This was designed with restaurants and shops on the lower level, and underground parking, so there wouldn't be a parking lot. I mean, it was the.
Sounds like you.
The developer went into huge lengths to get neighborhood input and make it as livable as possible.
Blocking out some of the guy's view.
Well, I think what Lynette's saying, and as she said, we're in the neighborhood as well, I really read it as it stood for Linden Hills becoming something which it was not currently. Now, we can debate about whether it already is, because there already are these apartment buildings, mm-hmm. et cetera, but that was my read, was that we think that we're a little small town in the city, and we don't want, and we want to stay exactly that way. And I think that is a that attitude underlays an enormous number of American attitudes toward cities in general. Actually, I'm going to read a little bit here that now this overstates it. Okay, so but this is by a guy that tends to overstate things. The idea of a modest dwelling all our own, isolated from the problems of other people, has been our reigning metaphor of the good life for a long time. I don't believe we can continue to keep pretending that life is a never-ending episode of Little House on the Prairie. We are going to have to develop a different notion of the good life and create a physical form that accommodates it. And a friend of mine says that he thinks that the Little House on the Prairie is the quintessential American book, because whenever Pa sees a smokestack on the horizon, he says, "That's getting crowded around here."
Move west.
Yes.
One thing we haven't talked about yet is diversity, mm-hmm. racial mm-hmm. diversity.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I live in a more racially diverse part of the city than a lot of people do.
Yep.
And I see people of all different colors, and I hear different languages being spoken. I think that plays a lot into the attitude and the fears that people have that their neighborhood is going to turn mm-hmm. into something that they're not going to.
Mm-hmm.
Or just that other.
Yeah, mm-hmm. right.
Right.
Feeling. And I think that maybe drives a lot of the attitudes.
I think you're right. I think the zoning that precludes apartments or any kind of multi-unit dwelling is very much centered around the fear of those people that rent.
And I have a group home on my block, and I have, I have a lot of different things that nobody can get zoned
right.
anywhere
yes.
else.
Yeah, right.
One of the interesting things about that is that those concerns can come back to bite us, because when you don't have more affordable housing, it can keep out others, but it can also keep your parents from coming back and living. It can keep out firemen. Your children can't afford. We talk about the different stages of housing. I mean, I went to what we'd probably consider a good school and had an okay job at one point. I was living in the diviest conceivable apartment building because, I had big loans to pay off, et cetera, and entry-level job, And the existence of that divey apartment building made it possible for me to live in that community, have that job, and be in that place, right? Mm-hmm. And I think we need divey apartment buildings, because otherwise people can't come home again. Or you don't have firefighters, right? And so it's, I'm just piling on your comment, but it is partially fear, but it's also, what we don't always think about is that letting folks in, it's good hospitality, we should be welcoming of diversity, et cetera. It's also just good for us in a lot of cases. And depending on where one is and who one is talking to, it's useful to remember that as well. Chris?
I don't know the answer to this, but it's odd to me that suburbanization seems to be a multinational phenomenon, not just a U.S. phenomenon. And there's an attitude or a desire for a certain kind of house and a certain kind of life behind people's buying of houses in neighborhoods like that. And I've never had that desire, and I don't really understand. Like, we were just in South Africa in Cape Town last fall, and there are sprawling suburbs going out from downtown Cape Town. I mean, they're white and upper class, and there's a really different thing for the colored and African population, but nonetheless, among the population that can afford it, that's what's growing. And that's bizarre. I mean, London, trips to England, that's happening. And so do you think that's true, first of all, that's a phenomenon that's much more broad than just the U.S.? And why do people want to live like that?
Well, I could ask folks here, but since you asked me, I'd throw my two cents in, and then we can throw it open. First of all, I mean, the factual question, yes, it's not just American, the Little House on the Prairie phenomenon notwithstanding. And, you know, any profession has, you know, different wings, right? And I'm on one side, if you will, of a lot of these things. There's, you know, a guy who spends most of his time going around giving talks like this, you know, bizarro will, right? Everybody is building suburbs. Everybody wants suburbs. Everyone wants to drive. It's a good thing. It's where people are getting what they want. It's beautiful. Let's do more, right?
These are the men talking about. It's the women driving.
Touché.
We need more women engineers, like numbers of bathrooms at North.
Yeah, right.
They need another viewpoint other than.
Good point. We are a slave to our minivans.
I would say on the opposite end, I can't speak for other cities, but I can tell you that in Portland, the hot place to live is not out in the suburbs.
Yeah.
People are paying big bucks to live in the, you know, the 20-story condos in the Pearl or in South Waterfront.
Sure,
and, you know, they're gorgeous. And many people, because I have friends that live in some of these, I go to their homes and they invite in the neighbors, and the neighbors move to Portland. Their kids are in Portland, and they're out in one of the suburbs. And they said, forget that. We want to be downtown. We don't want to drive. Kids have to come to see us. So, you know, in some regards, but that's money, too.
Sure.
It's not low income.
And I think, I really do think this goes back to attitudes, and I think, you know, I'm not going to be so condescending as to say, oh, the South Africans are going to come to their senses and start moving back in as well. But we are seeing a sea change here in the States where someone who has spent a lot of time looking at the real estate markets in these various says that we now have enough single-family detached houses in the U.S. for the next 20 years worth of demand. What we don't have is all the Pearl Districts, is all the downtowns, is all that. We need
affordable.
And affordable, right. And so that's why you see a lot of, and you know, just to go back to Minneapolis, but there's an enormous line of cities going north and west from the Minneapolis region that have platted and in some places put down sewers for and planned for, you know, all this exurban growth, and it's just evaporated. It is completely evaporated. And now some people say it's coming back, right? Because we're just in this economic cycle, and other people will say, and for what it's worth, I'm on this, you know, I'm with the people that said attitudes have changed. It's not coming back. People don't want to do that anymore. And I'd say that because the young people don't want to do that, right? They crave that contact. Now a lot of it's electronic, but even the electronic part, you can't be driving if you're, right?
you
laugh, but it is absolutely serious. You laugh, people who, you know, are paid a lot of money by car companies to understand this kind of thing, that young people will choose their phone over a car.
That's right.
Literally.
Or
so,
they're putting so much computerized stuff in the dashboard of a car, the question has been brought up, is it safe for drivers? Because they many screens and buttons.
Right. Yeah.
We're patient. Yes.
Yes. Heading back to the slide that you had about forced contact and going around attitudes, I'm from Vancouver, BC, and there is a currently just starting to happen conversation around that because one of the problems that recent study has shown is that people and the majority of housing stock in and around the downtown core in Vancouver is high-rises, that the high-rise typology, which we have been building lots and lots of in the last decade, actually creates forced non-contact, that most of us who live in high-rises, myself included, don't really know our neighbors, even though we share elevators with them.
Right.
They're, you know, just on the opposite side of the
right.
wall.
Right.
And so you end up with sort of a more suburban attitude that, yes, you are in a city, but things need to shut down after 10. But on the flip side, if you say that, then are you creating a city that has the advantages of having artistic growth, creating opportunities for creativity, et cetera,
yeah.
or
right.
are you creating a large resort for aging baby boomers?
Right, right. No,
or
that's
any
a
number
great
of
question.
Other things?
That's a great question. One of the, and I'll, or it's a great observation, not so much a question, but unless you have.
There's a follow-on observation.
Sure, absolutely. The one of the things people will say is that Americans hate sprawl and density. Right, and so on both sides. And part of the difficulty of having the debate then is, oh well, you're in favor of those Vancouver high rises, and right, and oh well, you're in favor of those horrible McMansions, you know. And the debate gets polarized very quickly. And what one of the things that I have tried to do, a lot of people are trying to do professionally, is try and put pictures to what people think about, exists, you know, they have these pictures in their heads, right? Density equals the Vancouver, Hong Kong, you know. You know, Paris is a gorgeous city of 4- and 5-story buildings. And it's enormously dense, and every one of those 4- and 5-story blocks knows each other largely, you know, in different French ways. But, you know, this is the kind of. That's not what I meant. No, it's just reading a lovely book about how, you know, these relationships evolve, and you know this guy and he knows this other guy, and it just sounds like a nice. Anyway, but you know, here's a 3-story building, and you know, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that you're not having that forced non-contact in this. Like, people probably leave each other mostly alone. If you want to see people, you can do that down here. You're going to run into them, right? And kids are going to know each other, families are going to know each other, this is not a sort of a forced contact kind of tenement kind of situation. I mean, I think we've learned a lot about apartment design, and these are the kinds of things which are going for a lot of money because people really want to live in them. And I was clicking
that,
around.
That one right, no.
The courtyard
houses that they have, like on Whidbey Island and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
That's a way to have density while still having a house.
Yes,
right.
Right. Exactly. That's exactly
mm-hmm.
right. That's exactly right.
I joke about gated communities. There are some if they could, they'd also put a dome.
Sure.
Yes.
And it does not bode well. I know a lot of people may be that fearful where they feel better to get to my house, you have to go through a gate.
Right.
Maybe you may talk about this, but for example, what was here before that was there? What's the displacement factor
yeah.
of urban planning? Where do all those people go so I can move back from my suburban
yeah.
place and live there?
Right.
There's a lot of, the old-fashioned word gentrification.
Yeah, no, that's true.
I'm just wondering what
that's a great question. There are a lot of different answers. I mean, there are a lot of, depending
what's
on the city,
answer?
Right? There are enough, American cities hollowed out enough in most cases that there's plenty of room downtown in the city for this sort of thing without displacing a lot of people. It is challenging to have a lower income neighborhood share in the wealth when other people decide, oh, this is cool after all, and I want to move back in. One of the interesting, because they can't buy, right? They don't have the capital to buy. one of the really interesting models is a shared equity where they'll buy a chunk of the house, and so they share in the rising value of that house. The land bank or the community development corporation, whoever else that owns the rest of it, also shares in the increasing value. As their equity increases, they can take out more money, buy more land for more, you know, and produce more of these so that the price can come down. That's a really cool model that people are working on right now. It makes banks nervous because, I mean, two people are owning the house. I mean, the land bank and the family, well, isn't that what happens anyway? I mean, we own part of our house and the bank owns the rest of it, so, right? But it, all these new models make people nervous. But you're absolutely right. And it's when places get more expensive, they get more expensive. They do. And
I lived in St. Cloud mm-hmm. 10, 12 years ago. And there they had just started in the free county area that any new development had to have as part of its plan mm-hmm. some low income housing so that you don't ghettoize,
yes.
but you kind of diversify. That has its own built in problems.
Yes.
But
that's
another bond.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's been an hour, and you've been fabulous. I have a passion for this, so I'm happy to sit around and talk for as long as you like. But if you would like to also go and get ice cream, just to take a hypothetical,
that's after. That's after.
You may do that as well.
Yay!